choice over to Exxon or BP or Shell by default. The choice is ours. It falls on us as the people who just happen to be alive at this consequential moment in human history. As many of you know too, even full decarbonization of our energy system is not enough, for there's legacy carbon up in the atmosphere that has brought us well beyond the limits of 350 parts per million. All of these serial climate disasters happening now are caused not by tomorrow's emissions, but by past emissions since the Industrial Revolution. And so, as scientists make clear, we need to clean up the sky to restore climate balance. There's no magic vacuum cleaner yet to suck carbon out of the sky. The only present way we have is from nature's own engines of carbon sequestration. Trees and soils can sequester massive amounts of carbon. That's the good news. But we've destroyed so many of these landscapes that we've essentially gummed up these natural engines of drawdown. Techniques called natural climate solutions involve restoring these vital carbon areas, the forests, the wetlands, the tideland areas, grasslands, and farmlands. And these techniques are crucial also to restoring biodiversity, and they need to be greatly scaled up and accelerated to meet the urgency we face. So these requirements, decarbonization, drawdown, and also biodiversity protection, come to us as nature's laws. These are the non-negotiable laws. But when we look to the statutes of yesterday, we don't find anything in them geared towards solving our converging crises. We have to use every minute of these coming days strategically and match our planetary defense effort to the scale and urgency of the danger we face. My second beacon focuses on our fundamental rights and the litigation that enforces them. In this new era, we must assert not requests, but rights. And government courts play a key role in that. Recall the main takeaway lesson of fifth grade civics class. Our constitutional system rests on three, not two, branches of government. And the judiciary remains crucial to holding the political branches in check and enforcing the fundamental rights of citizens. Those are not statutory rights, they're fundamental rights. In civil rights cases, prisoner abuse cases, treaty fishing cases, courts have forced delinquent officials to create plans to correct their systemic violations of the people's rights. Now, the judges don't create these plans. That's the government's job. But courts can supervise progress, and in that way, they don't overstep their role. I know in this political climate that many of you are wary of the judicial branch because of the recent appointments to the Supreme Court. But lower federal courts and state courts exist across the country, and those judges are enforcing rights every day. And it is dangerously simplistic to think that we can just cross off one entire branch of government in any strategy. The pioneering litigation that brought fundamental rights to environmental law in this country was spearheaded by Our Children's Trust. And they brought litigation on behalf of youth asserting public trust rights to a stable atmosphere. Before that, climate challenges were just statutory, like seeking ESA listing of the polar bear and Clean Air Act listing of carbon dioxide as a pollutant. In Juliana versus the United States, filed on behalf of 21 youth plaintiffs in the Federal District Court of Oregon, for the first time ever, there was assembled hard evidence showing that the fossil fuel energy system of the United States was putting young people in existential danger. With Eugene's own Kelsey Juliana as the lead plaintiff, those youth sought a declaration of their rights and a government plan to decarbonize the energy system. And they had the evidence to show the government knowingly brought about this danger, and they just wanted a plan from government to pull the nation out of danger before it would be too late. They won a historic ruling in 2016 when Judge Ann Aiken declared in words that swept across the world within hours, the right to a stable climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society. And that decision inspired cases in many other nations. In fact, another was filed just last week by 12 youth in Austria. And young people have gained victories in Colombia, the Netherlands, Germany, Pakistan, France, and elsewhere. And in this country, OCT's state cases are soon going to trial in Montana and Hawaii. I view this as the leading front of environmental American law, with profound importance for our survival and our democracy. But we saw in a later stage of the Giuliani case that some judges will write themselves out of our constitutional democracy at the time we need them most. On a premature appeal of this Giuliani case in 2020, Judge Hurwitz began the majority opinion stating that the government's fossil fuel policy was hastening an environmental apocalypse. That's a direct quote. And you would have thought, reading that, that this judge would certainly use his judicial authority to restrain government from consummating the apocalypse. But instead, he went on to say that courts can grant no conceivable remedy. He punted the matter entirely to the political branches. Can you see that this judge gives full loyalty to that political discretion frame that brought us this climate emergency? His vision of an enfeebled judiciary would represent a titanic shift in the balance of power in this country. Don't expect your fundamental rights to last if courts won't enforce them in any meaningful way. Another judge on the panel, though, Judge Staten, wrote a dissent, and she said, well, she challenged the political discretion frame in just near disbelief, and she said, government insists that it has the absolute, unreviewable power to destroy this nation, and that my colleagues throw up their hands in response. She found that government instead has a clear duty to preserve the nation and that courts provide the ultimate backstop. And know this, while the Ninth Circuit denied a remedy, the court did not question the constitutional right that Judge Aiken announced, the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life. That right is yours. And so voice it everywhere you can. And let's not forget this. Throughout our history, judges have enforced the public trust rights of the people. You know, remember that Lodestar Illinois Central case involving the Chicago shoreline? Well, the justices back then said it would not be listened to that the control and management of the harbor of that great city, a subject of concern to the whole people of the state, should be placed in the hands of a private corporation. Can't you practically hear those justices saying today, it would not be listened to. The government would let fossil fuel corporations pollute our air, heat up our atmosphere, threaten our children's future, and destroy the habitability of this nation and the entire planet? It would not be listened to. A third beacon I will offer is moral authority. Moral authority resides within each of us. And when we voice it, we move an unjust world towards justice. Moral authority gathers momentum from a righteous core. It reveals stark truths that can dislodge even long-held beliefs. Moral outrage taps an irrepressible urge in people to do something. We see it rising all around us in calls for police reform and economic equality. Whenever we talk about climate, bring in the youth. They hold the most powerful moral authority, having done nothing to create a crisis that they will have to deal with their entire lives. Asserting moral authority doesn't have to be hard or time-consuming. It can be done, in fact, best done, in everyday conversations and encounters with strangers. It can be displayed on billboards and bumper stickers and signs held by youth marching in the streets, and they've asked you to join them. But industry lobbyists would love it instead if the public would just stay down in those deep statutory caverns, because those never really galvanize moral outrage over its proposals. Those statutes use a blather of incomprehensible acronyms and techno jargon to permit deplorable destruction. So though environmental law houses a den of thieves, the public often perceives no theft. When we limit ourselves to statutory law, we focus on things like the lack of cumulative effects analysis or improper categorical exclusions, or missed notice requirements. Yet, we have to mention those things to hang arguments on legal hooks. I totally agree. But let's not limit ourselves to the faint and muffled complaints from the bottom of those statutory caverns. One person who's not muffled is the UN chief. Here's what he recently told the world. Humanity has a choice. Cooperate or perish. It's either a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact. No more bottomless greed of the fossil fuel industry and its enablers. People are rising in civil disobedience all over the world in moral outrage against fossil fuels, scaling coal fire plants, and they're blocking oil trains and protesting at DAPL. They are asserting their moral authority through peaceful civil disruption. And yes, they get arrested. In fact, they intend to. Eugene's own Civil Liberties Defense Center and Laura Regan helped gain remarkable judicial victories establishing the climate necessity defense in some of these criminal trials. This defense, I mean, many thought it couldn't be done just a few years ago, but that defense flips the focus because it asks whether the activists' peaceful disruption was justified to avert a much greater harm caused by burning fossil fuels. Now, do you see how this defense can put the fossil fuel industry on trial in the trials of these defendants? This is a legal front that criminal lawyers are taking forward, premised on the moral authority to peacefully disrupt systems that threaten human civilization as we know it. And it is the role of the broader community, those who don't risk arrest, to support them and demand the freedom that entitles their peaceful disruption. The fourth beacon leads us towards system overhaul. Remember, for the last 50 years, we've confronted environmental problems through our statutory permit systems alone. And even when a proposal is defeated, industry throws more permit applications one right after the other, and defeating them becomes the public's game of whack-a-mole. We need to break out of that cycle. We can't solve problems with the same thinking that created them, as Albert Einstein would say. Those harmful proposals, they will just keep on coming because our industrial society invites them and our statutory law offers no economic alternative. Environmental law never thought of a way to offer gentle living on this planet. The statutes passed a half century ago don't really connect to any economic reality, and they lack basic mechanisms to rebuild systems. I've never heard of a football team using only defense as a strategy. Games are won by moving the ball down the field to the goal. So let's apply this to environmental law. We can't just have a just-say-no approach without an alternative vision. Our public agencies, they need to stop spending our taxpayer money legalizing damage and stop wasting all of our time fighting these endless permits and turn their staff time and programs towards building a regenerative economy. Reconfiguring systems requires tools beyond mere regulation, tools like subsidies, taxes, and conservation easements. We need to throw as much money as we can to actually decarbonize society and not just regulate towards that end. And we have a robust start with the Inflation Reduction Act, which authorizes $369 billion to invest in new systems for climate recovery. That is great. We now need to make sure that money is spent wisely, because you and I both know there's going to be one big money grab going on. So while statutory lawyers hold the line of defense, another league of lawyers must dive into the business of creating new systems, dealing with energy, food, transportation, housing, waste. And if those systems are in fact sustainable, the need for regulation retreats. These environmental lawyers will be highly transactional, making deals, finding partners, engaging other disciplines, forming vision and strategy, solidifying commitments. Well, the last beacon I will introduce is one called Big Vision. So if statutory law shoves people down into caverns, big visions lift them out. They connect and they inspire. When we fight for the environment using whatever laws we can, let us realize that our individual battle is never the end game. The threat you are fighting is part of an onslaught of similar threats all over the place. If we don't connect the innumerable battles going on to save our ecology and our communities, we forfeit that unique power and leverage that comes from calling out systemic injustice. In the Pacific Northwest, we have witnessed the power of what I would call connective action. Our region sits squarely between the vast coal and oil and gas deposits of interior America and the expanding energy markets of Asia. And several years ago, a dangerous axis of multinational corporations targeted our region to serve as its global gateway for fossil fuel exports to Asia. It pummeled Oregon and Washington within a couple years with 26 proposals for major export facilities, including what would have been North America's largest oil terminal in Vancouver and a coal export terminal at the Lummi Nation's ancient treaty fishing site on the Salish Sea, and the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas facility in Coos Bay, along with a pipeline that would snake across the entire state of Oregon, and 23 more proposals. And these were all approved initially by local officials, which is so often the case. Do you have any idea of the carbon bomb these would carry to the climate system and the incalculable destruction they would bring to our glorious region? If you were fighting one of those, you knew it. But then, can you also see the stunning leverage that this region holds over the ruinous ambitions of this industry by connecting all 26 proposals in one single vision? If you were fighting one of those, I'll bet you came to see that too. Sightline Institute out of Seattle ignited a regional movement when it suggested a thin green line along Cascadia beyond which none shall pass. Suddenly, 26 isolated proposals became a united front that turned against the fossil fuel industry. Citizens across this region found the project nearest them. They connected with local organizers. They brought in friends and coworkers and neighbors, and they swarmed those projects. They wrote letters. They flooded public hearing rooms. They called in the press and took to the streets, the bridges, their kayaks to resist. This region became a front line against climate destruction. And you know, I like to tell the public, you can think of every one of those statutory permit schemes as setting up a different playing field of environmental law. Each permit requirement, there's usually about a dozen for every big project. Each one sets up a different playing field. In the vast majority of cases, the public doesn't even show up. So industry dominates those playing fields, and those permits fall into place like a row of dominoes. But if the public comes out in strong numbers, things can go the other way. And consider this. Any large project requires about a dozen permits. The public only needs to win on one playing field, whereas the industry proponent needs to win on all. Well, this none shall pass uprising turned the tide on those playing fields, and agencies started denying permits. And it was amazing, and nearly every one of those projects died on different playing fields by different agencies using different laws, local, state, and federal. And this onslaught is not over, but the thin green line still holds today. And if this region asserts its power through connective action, those fossil fuels destined for Asia will stay in the ground. This is how to use environmental statutory law. No matter what kind of permit or process we face, connect our action to a broader and more encompassing vision and bring in people who you don't yet know. Because big visions create momentum and they embolden leaders and courts. So let's not talk about defeating just one pipeline. Let's talk about leaving fossil fuels in the ground. And let's not stop just one clear cut. While we're out, let's leave forests in the ground. And let's not talk about fish passage. Let's talk about dam decommissioning. And while we're at it, Let's talk about restoration in all its forms. Rewilding, land back, environmental justice, decarbonization, sky cleanup. These are among the intrepid fronts leading the transition. And to gain the clearest vision forward, we might look to those with the longest vision back, those with ancestral memory going back to time immemorial on this landscape. It is the tribes who are bringing cultural burning as an alternative to the industrial fire complex. It is the tribes who introduced gravel-to-gravel management of the Pacific salmon, a species that has sustained them for 10,000 years. It is the tribes who call for bringing down the dams and who do much of the hard work to actually accomplish that. And it is the tribal elders who've seen the sacred songs at rivers, beckoning those salmon's return once again to their natal waters. So as we look into the future, we can see a transition already happening across the land. As sure as a farmer somewhere is dousing Roundup across the field, there is just as surely somewhere else a young farmer who says to her grandfather, "Let's try cover crops instead." And while somewhere a developer bulldozes native grassland, there is somewhere else a land trust planting habitat for migrating birds. While somewhere a well is pumping fracked gas, somewhere else a person is installing solar panels. And while the Dalles Dam still silences the roar of Salado Falls, the Klamath Dams are coming down, and the Elwha and the white salmon now flow free. And it is said that tribal people who knew Salado Falls as children still smell its mist and hear its roar. Isn't that enough for a vision? Restoration is powerful because it leads us in the right direction. After a century and a half of momentum in exactly the wrong direction, with our laws legalizing assaults against nature everywhere, finally, the minds of people all over the world are turning to a better way. The youth and children of this world have inherited unspeakable ecological threats, and there will be incalculable losses to come. But if they know that their society is turning towards recovery, if they know we are serious about giving them the best chance to survive and thrive on this planet, they will enter this severe climate transition with a resolve that is buoyed by a vision of a better future. I will close by saying that the transition ahead will be unprecedented and uncertain. Environmental law, as we define in the future, will either organize society's final assaults on nature, or it will catalyze a planetary defense of nature. It will either fuel a final tyranny, or it will breathe new life into democracy. As we think of how to reframe environmental law to serve us in the future, let us not put the responsibility or the honor of that on just those of us in this room. We must enlist everyone we can to join. Nature's laws govern everyone. We all have fundamental rights to bring. We all hear the call of moral authority that tells us what we bear on our shoulders for the future of humanity. And all of our talents are needed to rebuild the systems necessary to support life on this planet. It will take all of us in this living generation to rise to this moment. We did not live 100 years ago when people could not even imagine this climate emergency. And we will not live 100 years forward when it will be too late. In fact, if we wait even 10 years, it will be too late. This moment belongs to us alive right now. We can't throw it all away. Let us claim our moment by asserting not the power of life, but the trust of life. And if there are still birds in the sky and fish in the sea and trees on the land and gardens bearing food 100 years from now, our descendants will know in their hearts that we stood to claim our moment to secure this vital natural endowment for all generations to come.
You were just listening to Mary Wood on environmental law and the defense of nature. She gave the keynote address of the annual Public Interest Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene in early March. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Mary Wood on Environmental Law and the Defense of Nature, and for the Noam Chomsky book, Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Call us at 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A new video game called High Water immerses players in a dystopian world ravaged by climate change-induced floods, war, and chaos. Igor Simic is CEO and creative director of Demagogue Studios, which created High Water. In the game, players help a teenager named Nico sneak onto a rocket ship the rich have built to flee to Mars.
Since wars are raging, people are dying of dysentery, etc., he wants to move to a better life.
To get there, Nikos must navigate the landscape by boat, collect his friends, and fight adversaries. Along the way, players face moral questions.
So, for example, you might decide not to help someone because there isn't enough space in your boat, or you might decide to help them.
The game is satirical at times. Simic says it's meant for entertainment, not to preach about climate change. But the creators were influenced by natural disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina and flooding in Serbia.
That triggered something, just the images of boats going around water that is up to the first floor or second floor.
So while the game depicts a fictional world, it reflects real fears people have about climate disasters. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
listening to